Hello and welcome to the Scholar's Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, do animals get depression, alcoholism, eating disorders? We'll explore the surprising common ground between animals and us and what we can learn from animals about healing. Then, the politics of immigration today and throughout U.S. history. Barbara Natterson Horowitz is with us. She is a cardiology professor at the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA and serves on the medical advisory board of the Los Angeles Zoo. Catherine Bowers is also with us. She was a staff editor at The Atlantic and a writer and producer at CNN International. Together, they co-authored the book Zoobiquity, The Astonishing Connection Between Human and Animal Health. Welcome to the two of you. So great to have you with us. Barbara Natterson Horowitz, let's start with you. You opened this book with this vignette about where you had this aha moment. And you're a cardiologist, but you were actually working with a monkey. What happened?
Right. Well, when this happened, I'd been happily practicing cardiology at UCLA Medical Center, you know, on human patients with heart attacks and high cholesterol. And then I had this opportunity to join the medical advisory board of our local zoo. And, you know, of course, zoos around the country are staffed by highly qualified veterinarians who take excellent care of their patients. But from time to time, the vets will sometimes reach into the human medical community just for assistance with, you know, something. And I happen to be an expert in cardiac imaging. So I had this opportunity to occasionally leave my human patients and go to the zoo and hang out with the veterinarians. And it was there, a couple of things happened. The first was I heard the vets on rounds talking about congestive heart failure in a gorilla or breast cancer in a tiger or, you know, compulsive disorders in a polar bear. And it was the first time that I had really thought that the same diseases that I was taking care of my human patients, veterinarians take care of in all kinds of animal patients. So that was one of the early aha moments. But then there was this one particular patient that I became involved with. It was a tamarin monkey. Tamarin monkeys are these adorable little Central and South American monkeys. They live at the top of the canopy of the rainforest. And on this day, they wanted a cardiac ultrasound done on this tamarin. And while I was there, they were giving the monkey some sedative to make her sleepy. I approached her very closely, and I looked deep into her eyes, and I said, "Oh, you're so, you know, cute little Spitzbuben." And I was trying to reassure her, to comfort her, like I would do with a human patient. But the vet put his hand on my shoulder and said, "Please back away. You're scaring her, actually. You're going to give her capture myopathy." And I'd never heard of capture myopathy. Myopathy is a medical term. It means disease of the muscle. But, you know, capture myopathy, I've never heard of. So I went home and I Googled it, and I learned that there's this syndrome that vets have been describing and treating and preventing for decades, involving animals who are really, really scared or who are, you know, who are being chased or restrained, that their bodies can become flooded with adrenaline, which can poison the muscles of their body, including their heart muscles sometimes, and on occasion they can actually die. And this was particularly interesting because there was a recently characterized human condition, something called stress cardiomyopathy or, you know, the broken heart syndrome, in which human physicians had described patients who had experienced traumatic events, seeing a loved one die or losing their life savings with the roll of a dice, being left at the altar, really awful experiences, they too could be flooded with adrenaline and sometimes have an acute heart failure and die. And so as I was reading about capture myopathy, particularly reading reports of it going back decades, and then thinking about this human syndrome, which had only recently been characterized, I just realized that, you know, there was this gulf between veterinary and human medicine, and that vets knew all kinds of things that we physicians might not know, and this is an opportunity to really create some bridges.
You said that vets knew all this material that doctors for humans don't know. Is the reverse also true?
Well, yeah, I mean, definitely. Physicians specialize in one species, so we typically, not only are we quite expert on Homo sapiens, in human medicine there's a tremendous amount of subspecialization. So in my case, for example, yes, I'm an internal medicine doctor, but then I specialized in cardiology, and then within cardiology I do imaging, and then within imaging I do a specific kind of imaging. So we get narrower and narrower. So yes, there are going to be pieces of things that we physicians know that vets don't know. But very traditionally, there's been passage of information from the human side to the veterinary side. What has been missing is us physicians and nurses and folks on the human side really looking at all of this knowledge in the veterinary literature that has been overlooked on the human side. So the arrow has pointed from the human to the animal, but Not so much from the animal to the human.
The most surprising elements of your book, Zubiquity, for me, were some of the behavioral or psychological, psychophysical disorders that animals also get. It was quite fascinating, for example, to find out about animals and addiction, and that animals get addicted just as humans do to particular substances. I remember reading about the dog that was licking the toad. Catherine Bowers.
This was something I was also surprised by. I approached this topic as a journalist and a writer, and I was surprised at how little I myself knew about the overlaps between animal medicine and human medicine. In terms of addiction, of course, most animals are not going to patronize their local corner liquor store or their corner drug dealer or their pharmacist, but those active ingredients in all of those intoxicants are found in nature, in fermented berries and natural, let's say, opiates in something like a poppy, and animals will eat those and get high. We found examples of bighorn sheep who scale cliffs in order to get their dose of a hallucinogenic lichen, and sometimes they grind their teeth down to the gums trying to get their fix of it. We talked to veterinarians who are sometimes called to the scene where massive flocks of birds have died en masse after consuming fermented berries and then essentially flying while intoxicated. And sadly, they often fly into buildings and die of the same kinds of things that human drunk drivers die of, broken backs and internal bleeding and things like that.
And then there was the animal that would go into the poppy farms.
Yes, that was in Tasmania. Tasmania is where they grow most of the world's opium that's meant for medical use. And they have these big fields of poppies and fences around them, but that doesn't keep a certain individual from sometimes jumping into the fence and eating the poppy straw and sap. And then those individuals sometimes get high and thrash around and have to be removed the next morning. And those are actually wallabies.
So what does this tell us about human addiction when we look at the animal kingdom? As you pointed out in your book, Zubiquity, it's not that every animal becomes an addict. It's only some animals that become addicted. Barbara Natterson-Horowitz, how can we use this to understand our own addictions?
There's the medical piece and then the more sort of psychosocial piece in terms of how it can help us. Medically, you know, one of the most interesting things we learned is that not all animals, even within a group, are going to be equally interested in partaking, that there are going to be differences. And why that is probably the answer in animals is the same as it is in humans. It's a combination of genetics and probably life experiences. I mean, we now know that the experiences, you know, of early childhood and even sometimes gestation can affect which of our genes are turned on and not turned on, and that, in fact, can then affect our behavior and our responsiveness to drugs. So that variation within a group of animals in terms of interest in and then continued use, I think, is interesting. And the other piece which that connects to is just addiction. It continues to be, unfortunately, such a stigmatized medical problem, and people who suffer with this issue not only deal with an extremely challenging, you know, biophysical problem, they also deal with stigma, shame, a lot of misunderstanding and blame. And, you know, we think that for some patients, just knowing that addiction is not uniquely human, in fact, it is species-spanning. There are examples from it in the wild that naturalists have been writing about for decades. That knowledge itself can help some suffering patients.
There were others that were also what we would think would be human behaviors uniquely, but you point out that these are found in the animal kingdom, some obsessive compulsive behaviors, this sort of seemingly self-destructive behavior, like the horse biting itself over and over again till it bleeds. Catherine Bowers.
Yeah, I was really interested in these overlapping behaviors that I had always thought of as being uniquely human, as being some sort of combination of our big human brains that were somehow massively different from other animals and our culture. Now, of course, a lot of what we do as humans is a result of a combination of our culture and our specific evolution that makes us human and not something else. But the idea that there's underlying behaviors that might drive a lot of similar behaviors, I think, is really worth looking at. We looked at the question of self-harm and self-injury, and that seems to me to be something that only a person would think about doing. You know, you hear about cutters sometimes. Psychiatrists call people who self-harm cutters.
There were some famous ones.
In our research, we found out that Princess Diana was somebody who talked publicly about her cutting. Angelina Jolie, Johnny Depp and Colin Farrell are all others who have talked about this in either sort of video forums or in magazine articles. And it's something that when you talk to sufferers about it, they say that cutting gives them relief. And this was something that really surprised Barbara and me. How could something that causes your body harm actually give you relief? And so by asking, do animals ever self-injure, that allowed us to take it out of the realm of culture and human behavior and just see if there's something about the act of cutting that can help all patients.
And what did you find?
Well, what we realized was that an animal is not going to take a tool and carve into its skin, but they have another arsenal of sharp objects that they can sometimes put on themselves, and that includes talons and claws and their own teeth. We learned that, as you said, horses who are isolated in stalls will sometimes start a behavior called flank biting. It's where they bite at their own sides, and they bite and they bite and they bite until they draw blood and sometimes continue to bite. And what veterinarians have noticed is that if they return that animal to its herd, which is the natural social grouping that it evolved to be a part of, sometimes those behaviors will stop. And if it's not possible to return the animal to its herd, sometimes they just give it a companion, sometimes a little chicken or a goat, and the presence of another animal with it in the stall will help it stop those behaviors. We think that that's, so found in our research is that when veterinarians return a self-injuring horse to its herd or provide it with a companion, sometimes those behaviors will stop.
What does that tell us?
Well, I think it speaks to potentially why human patients self-injure. I mean, this is one of these challenges clinically that is kind of like so shocking. Hearing patients describe the act of cutting oneself as being a source of relief and release, it feels very counterintuitive. But when you talk to veterinarians about how they understand why and how self-injury occurs, it begins to take a different shape. I mean, a lot of animals, from reptiles and fish to birds and mammals, use grooming to self-soothe. We do it ourselves. You know, a lot of us when do little tiny grooming, micro-grooming, let's call it, activities to sort of calm ourselves throughout the day, either stroking our hair or, you know, picking at our cuticles or whatever it is. And animals, you see, even our cats and dogs in our homes, will begin to lick themselves and groom as a stress response. It does calm an animal to groom oneself. So some of these self-injurious behaviors that animals engage in center around grooming activities, but they are actually amplified grooming activities. So there's a kind of self-injury that some dogs engage in called acrylic dermatitis, but essentially it's a dog who's licking at its paw and then keeps licking at it and licks and licks and licks until the skin breaks, and they keep licking. They continue to do it until it's bleeding. And if you think about self-injury that way, that animal is probably licking as an attempt to soothe, and his stress may be such that that impulse to self-soothe gets dialed all the way up. If we think about human self-injury in those terms, then it can be seen as an attempt to soothe and probably an effort to have the body release some of the, you know, the internal opiates that are released in response to grooming.
One of the stories I thought were really interesting within the book dealt with this, and that was when there was surgery done on a gorilla, I believe it was, that in order to keep it from picking at its wound, they intentionally ungroomed it, you know, with chewing gum on his fur and painting his toenails so that he would pick at those things instead of at the wound. Catherine Bowers, what happened there?
Yeah, this was a gorilla named Babek who'd had a heart procedure done, and the doctors who worked on him wanted to make sure that he didn't pick and poke and reopen his surgical wound when he woke up. Barbara says in the book that she can tell her human patients, don't touch your wound, but you can't exactly tell that to a gorilla. So veterinarians have had to become very creative about how they keep animals from accidentally injuring themselves in their quest to groom themselves. So what they did was they surgically sewed Babek's chest wound back up, but then they painted his toenails bright red, and they put some chewed up chewing gum and then sterilized it in the microwave, let it cool, and worked it into his fur. And they sewed a few extra false stitches along other areas of his body so that when he woke up, instead of his fingers moving toward that chest wound, they had all of these other distractions that he could start picking at instead.
And did it work?
Yes. It did, and this was not unique to Babek either. This is a technique that veterinarians tell us they use a lot, especially with primates.
You know, there may be really an insight for human self-injuring patients that comes from that story, because one of the things we learned from veterinarians is that animals hurt themselves. They turn their own, you know, hands or beaks or whatever against themselves when they're bored. And boredom is a primary trigger. So one thought about a self-injuring patient, in the case of Bobek, they basically created all these distractions to keep his hands very busy, his fingers busy, you know, pulling the gum out and undoing the stitches. And it may be a little bit of metaphor, or maybe it's a practical idea that self-injuring human patients may be thought of in some sense as bored, not having enough stimulation, not having enough environmental enrichment, which is how the veterinarians would talk about it. And that's what a veterinarian would do for a self-injuring patient. He or she would enrich the environment, make it more interesting.
And obesity, eating disorders, we've seen this in the animal kingdom as well. How have we seen that?
Mrs. Catherine, Barbara and I, when we started this project, we had a kind of a concept that animals in the wild were probably lean and healthy and ate what you might call a perfect diet, a perfect organic diet. They stopped when they were sated, and they kind of had a nutritional wisdom about what they ate. But what we realized was that, and this was after talking to veterinarians and people who've observed a lot of animals in the wild, is that most animals, given the opportunity, will overconsume. But the difference is that most animals don't have constant access to lots and lots of food the way that we do. What we learned is that animals can become obese naturally the way human populations can become obese with just lots of extra food around. There's lots of other factors in obesity and the human obesity epidemic, and we look at a few of those too.
It's just also interesting to learn about the fascinating parallel on the animal side. Obesity in cats and dogs has become such an issue that there are diet pills that are marketed for dogs now. There is Pfizer has actually a drug that's for a diet pill for dogs. There is liposuction that's been done on some dogs, and there's even a diet that some prescribe for the obese feline, which is a low carbohydrate, high protein diet, which they call the Catkins diet. So, yeah, I mean, it's really a parallel problem.
In essence, what we're seeing is that it's really almost natural to overconsume.
Yeah, that was one of the sort of counterintuitive takeaways, that, in fact, having an internal satiety mechanism doesn't really make sense from an evolutionary perspective if your environment is almost certainly to have periods of scarcity. So if you're living in an environment where scarcity is likely, then when there's abundance, you should be hardwired to overconsume, to sort of store up. And that's seen in companion animals as well, and we share a common ancestor with, for example, dogs about 60 million years ago. So it seems as though these, you know, neurobiological impulses to overconsume are very ancient and conserved across, you know, a lot of mammalian species.
What about underconsumption?
Yeah, this was something we also asked ourselves, was if animals can become obese, can animals also get eating disorders, something that might look like human anorexia nervosa? And this was a place where Barbara and I were really skeptical, and we just thought there's no possible way, because if you think about anorexia nervosa as, let's say, a teen girl looking in the mirror saying, "I look fat," and then deciding to go on a calorie-restricting diet for that, then, of course, no animal is going to do that. But if you think of animal eating as tied in with social stress and predatory stress, then you start seeing that anxiety and stress can affect eating, and that's something that veterinarians will say also.
We actually learned about a syndrome that agricultural veterinarians have described. Some female pigs will deal with the transition from being dependent on the mother to being part of a more, you know, adolescent or adult hierarchy, herd hierarchy. Some of these females will respond to the stress by decreasing how much they eat, and some of them actually will stop eating altogether and actually starve themselves to death. So the question is, well, what are the linkages between that behavior in a pig and human anorexia nervosa?
And we also, this is Catherine, learned about dolphins and some primates who will force themselves to throw up after they eat, and it's often tied into social stress within their group, and it looks something like bulimia nervosa. And again, these are not identical syndromes because we're talking about different kinds of animals, but we think that these underlying deeper behaviors are really useful for psychiatrists to keep in mind as they're looking at their human patients.
Barbara, you brought up the linkages. Let's talk for a moment about linkages. Is there something that, say, psychiatrists can take away from the animal behavior to help treat humans who are dealing with either bulimia or anorexia? What is that linkage?
Mm-hmm. To go back to the destigmatizing piece, as a point of departure, I think it can be helpful to know that it's not uniquely human or disordered, that in fact non-human animals have the same kinds of problems, same food-related problems. For some patients, that can be helpful. But moving beyond that to mechanism, it's interesting to learn about this syndrome Catherine was talking about, regurgitation and reingestion in these marine mammals and great apes. And although veterinarians are quick to point out that this is not identical to bulimia nervosa in human beings, the self-induced vomiting seems to be an effort on the part of the animal to soothe themselves in the context of social stress. There's an interesting parallel in that some human patients with bulimia nervosa describe a soothing coming not only from the binge arc of the bulimia nervosa, but also from the purge. And then the question is, well, is there some neurobiological phenomenon in which vomiting leads to the release of some opiates or some, you know, endogenous chemicals that is providing a kind of soothing effect? And there's also a really interesting phenomenon among some animals, birds, for example, who will use vomiting as a defensive mechanism, literally an anti-predator kind of defense. The phenomenon is called defensive regurgitation. It's seen in vultures and other animals. And without being too metaphorical, it is interesting, I think, to a psychiatrist just to hear the term defensive regurgitation and begin to make connections.
Let's move into then some of the more what seems to be physical, like syncope, like heart disease, like cancer. When we reach back into the animal kingdom and even the ancient animal kingdom, which you talked about, like even as far back as dinosaurs, what do we draw from them to understand these disorders?
It's interesting just to kind of begin to turn the lights on a little bit and think about these really common, quote-unquote, human medical problems as, first of all, not uniquely human. So, yes, we're talking about syncope, which is fainting, or breast cancer and brain tumors, or heart attacks and all these kinds of problems. They're not uniquely human. But not only are they not uniquely human, they are not unique to our modern times. And this is one of these sort of what we call obvious/non-obvious kinds of realizations. Because, of course, any mammal, any animal with breasts, by definition, would be a mammal, could potentially get breast cancer. And it's actually been seen in mammals as varied as, you know, cats and dogs, camels and kangaroos, even beluga whales have been found to have breast cancer. And in fact, it undoubtedly occurred among ancient animals as well. During biblical times, there are references to human beings having a breast cancer, but much, much, much before that in non-human mammals. We saw an article that it was entitled The Epidemiology of Dinosaur Cancer that really went into kind of a list of all of the different tumors, some benign, some malignant, some primary, some metastatic, that had been found in the bones of all kinds of species of dinosaurs. And that just expanded the whole way that we started thinking about other kinds of diseases, by the way, including psychiatric illness, which I think we very often think of as not only uniquely human, but unique to our modern times.
One of the things that was interesting about breast cancer was that certain animals within the species get it less frequently, like milk cows.
Yeah.
Veterinarians call those the professional lactators, and they have noticed that they get breast cancer at much, much lower rates than other mammals do.
And so that's kind of telling as well.
Well, definitely it tracks with the human epidemiology that has shown that breastfeeding among, you know, human females is definitely provides some protection against breast cancer, you know, breastfeeding for a longer period of time. Yeah, it tracks and it's worth looking at.
And it makes you wonder about other kinds of cancers and what is the activity that protects the body in some way against that cancer, or can you make those connections?
Well, that's a really interesting question. We learned about a fascinating theory called Peto's paradox. There was a scientist, a British scientist, who noticed something very interesting. He made the point that if cancer is caused by mutation and cell division, then animals, species of animals that were very, very big, elephants and whales, for example, who would need to have many more cell divisions to attain their ultimate size, that they should be riddled with cancer. and that very tiny animals, like mice and whatever, birds, should have no cancer. And in fact, that was not the case. It turns out that very large animals, it seems, and it's a little hard to be sure about this, have a remarkably low incidence of cancer. And so that has sort of led evolutionary biologists and now some medical scientists to begin looking at what is it about the genome of very large species that could potentially be protecting them from cancer. And that's an exciting area to think about.
In terms of the medical community, the psychology community, the veterinarian community, what should we be thinking about as our next step?
We think the next step really is just to develop bridges of communication between the human and the animal side. It's unfortunate, but physicians and veterinarians have not really worked together in the past too much. Our schools are too often in different places, and we, the physicians, don't really read their literature or go to their conferences. So Catherine and I have actually developed Zubiquity conferences. We started here in Los Angeles, and the purpose is to bring together academic veterinarians and physicians to discuss the same diseases that they treat in different species. The first two that we had involved faculty from the UCLA School of Medicine and then faculty from the UC Davis School of Veterinary Medicine. And we have had cases of breast cancer presented. So we'll have, for example, you know, breast cancer in a 8-year-old Siamese cat and breast cancer in a 42-year-old psychotherapist. And we will have the cases presented, and then a physician comments on the animal case and the veterinarian comments on the human case, and then an auditorium composed of about 50% DVMs and 50% MDs will engage in this comparative conversation. And topics that we've covered in this way have included self-injury, anxiety disorders in dogs and in cats and in humans, bullying, brain tumors. And actually, what we then do in the afternoon is we take the entire group, we put everybody on a bus, and we go to our local zoo, the Los Angeles Zoo in this case, where the experts there, the veterinarians, lead the group on walk rounds. And so we have more discussion of, you know, animal, human, medical, and psychiatric parallels. We're really excited that in November the 2nd in Manhattan, the Wildlife Conservation Society and the Animal Medical Center of Manhattan will be sponsoring the third Zubiquity Conference, and we're going to be having some really wonderful medical talent from the great institutions of New York, Sloan Kettering, Columbia, Mount Sinai, NYU, and veterinarians from the AMC, from Tufts, from UPenn, from Cornell, who will be doing a similar kind of conference, and then in the afternoon we're going to all go to the Bronx Zoo, which is this wonderful, wonderful zoo for rounds. So we really feel that the first step is for physicians, nurses, psychotherapists, anyone who's dealing with providing care to human patients to begin thinking about the same problems on the animal side and talking to vets, going into their literature and attending these kinds of conferences.
Thank you so much, Catherine Bowers and Barbara Natterson-Horowitz. Really a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Catherine Bowers and Barbara Natterson-Horowitz are the authors of Zubiquity, The Astonishing Connection Between Human and Animal Health. When we come back, the politics of immigration, past and present. Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. Last week, the U.S. Senate began debating legislation to reform the country's immigration laws. The debate is not particularly new. Throughout U.S. history, similar arguments have resurfaced. How does today compare with the past, and what might be in the future? Gabriel Sanchez is with us. He is a professor of political science at the University of New Mexico and the author of numerous publications, including the book Hispanics and the U.S. Political System, Moving into the Mainstream. David Reimers also joins us. He is a professor emeritus of history at the University of Wisconsin. His books include Unwelcome Strangers, American Identity and the Turn Against Immigration. He's also the co-author of Natives and Strangers, A Multicultural History of Americans. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Professor Reimers, let's back up into American history and give this context. What do we need to know about the past to understand the present?
For many years, the federal government didn't do much about immigration, left it to the states. And then in 1875, the government embarked upon a policy of trying to regulate and control immigration. And that was prompted by a Supreme Court decision which said that the federal government must do this and not the states. And it was prompted also, obviously, by the migration of the Chinese to the West Coast. And there was an alarm spread up by working men's groups and various racial groups, et cetera. And the upshot was they began to pass legislation. The most important one was in 1882, when Chinese laborers were barred from the United States for 10 years. That was extended and made permanent in 1902, although it was repealed during World War II. The Chinese merchants could still come, diplomats and students, but it effectively killed Chinese immigration from any kind of growth. And Japanese immigrants began to come after that. So I'm making a point here that there's a lot of racism involved with immigration. Japanese were barred by a gentleman's agreement in which the government of the U.S. and Japan agreed that Japan would not give exit permits to unskilled laborers. Others were allowed to come. In fact, of course, many women came as brides, so-called picture brides, married by proxy. And Congress finally eliminated that in the 1920s. And also before that, Asian Indians were effectively barred by Congress in 1917. Koreans were barred along with the Japanese. As for the other groups, the legislatures began to pass a series of laws to cut down immigration outside of Asia. At first, this wasn't necessarily racial, but it quickly became. They passed laws that said that persons likely to become a public charge couldn't come in, or people with loathsome diseases couldn't come in. Or after McKinley was assassinated by a native-born American, they passed a law barring anarchists from coming in the United States. The most important thing, and you come back to race again, was a literacy test. It was proposed in the 1890s, mainly because it thought it would keep out Southern and Eastern Europeans. Italians were basically illiterate, et cetera. It wasn't finally passed until 1917 over Wilson's veto, but by then most of the people from Southern and Eastern Europe were able to pass the literacy test. No, if they're over 16, knowing a language, their own language or our English, it really didn't matter. And a lot of that was really part of a growing kind of racism in the United States, which was categorizing all kinds of groups. And as for Europeans, yes, Italians were white, but they really weren't quite white. And they were considered to be innately inferior, so were Slavs, Slovaks, etc. And there were also economic factors at work, too. Labor unions weren't very strong, but they thought that immigrant labor might be too cheap. Business groups wanted workers to come in, so they often push for immigration. Steamships made money off immigration, so they were pushing also as well. Railroads were involved in this, and Western states also wanted immigrants to settle in their area. So they were fighting over economic, racial, political factors. And during the Progressive Movement, some people began to argue, around 1900, 1910, argue that immigrants supported corrupt political machines, and they drank too much, et cetera, so it got tied up with Prohibition and an attempt to clean up local governments and so forth. The upshot was, as immigration was really growing, especially from Southern Eastern Europe after the 1880s and 90s, was that Congress was looking for ways to cut down on immigration, and eventually those who wanted to restrict it were able to override those who wanted more immigrants. And in the 1920s, they put into practice the national origin system, or quota system. What it did was to set a quota of 1/6 of 1% for the Eastern Hemisphere. Asians were barred by this, except for the groups I mentioned, the students, et cetera. And this quota was about 150,000. It went through various drafts. The upshot was whatever your group had in ratio of that 150,000, you got. So Italians figured out only have a few percent, so they got 5,800 based upon the national population in 1920. The English got 44%. The reason for that, you go back, English came first, and multiple generations, there are obviously many more people of English origin in the United States in the 1920s. And so England and Germany and Ireland got about 3/4 of all the spots of 150,000. They did didn't touch the Western Hemisphere. Why? Because the big growers in the West, railroads in the West, wanted cheap labor. And they also argued that if Mexicans came across the border, and the border was very loosely enforced before the 1920s, and even then not all that enforced, they would go home. So clearly an economic fight versus those who saw Mexicans as racially inferior and wanted to keep them out. The big growers won. And then came the 1930s, and you have a very low quotas for the Eastern Hemisphere Europeans, and those laws were really enforced because of the huge amount of unemployment. And the West Coast and some of the northwestern states going all the way up to Michigan, the government deported 300,000 or 400,000 Mexicans. Rather than put them on relief or whatever, they just shipped them back to Mexico. So that population dropped enormously. The 30s was a pretty nativist decade, and it's not only just the ideology, but when you have 25% unemployed, that's all a factor. So you deport Mexicans, and you make sure that not many Jewish or other political refugees get in from the rising tide of fascism in Europe. The big change and the shift about all of this comes after World War II, but suffice it to say, the immigration laws since the repeal of the Chinese Exclusion Act in 1943 have generally opened the door for more immigrants. We took in about 250,000 people in the late 40s and 50s, and in the last 20 years, we're averaging about 1 million per year. There are a variety of laws, the Hart-Celler Act, the Immigration Reform and Control Act of 1986, the Immigration Act of 1990, all of those laws enabled immigration to grow. They also led to shifting patterns, too, because it used to be practically all immigrants came before the 1920s from Europe, and beginning in the 70s, especially from Latin America and from Asia and the Middle East, the immigration has grown. The last 3 years, more people as immigrants have entered the United States from Africa than from Europe. The European immigration is low, and African immigration is growing. But all of this has undertaken a lot of fighting. The pro-immigrant groups, sometimes they're big growers, sometimes they're high-tech industries, or sometimes they're a variety of religious and ethnic organizations. There are people involved in Cold War politics who want to take in refugees and so forth, have had to contend with the traditional American ambivalence and at times hostility towards immigrants. So if you find really unusual things happening in the 1990s, they're passing laws trying to make immigration tighter. At the same time, they pass laws to allow a number of Central Americans to become refugees. When I read most of the literature, it's really focused on Mexico by the anti-people. It's almost a playback to the attitudes towards Italians.
Gabriel Sanchez, let's bring you in here, too, to talk about the modern dynamics of politics and policy now within this historic context. How do you see the current situation?
Well, I think there's a couple of key points that were pulled out of that very good historical narrative that are very, very relevant now. One of those is the role of the economy in this whole debate. And I think if you look at things over time, one of the key correlates is whenever the economy is in a recession or unemployment is problematic for the U.S., that's when you tend to see some backlash towards particularly the most vulnerable immigrants. And you see that in the context of history. It could be European immigrants, later it was Asian immigrants, and today it happens to be Latino and specifically Mexican immigrants. So that's kind of been consistent throughout the history of immigration policy and the attitudes of the public towards immigrants. The other thing that came out, and I'm very glad my colleague brought up the notion of race, because that's really the elephant in the room when you're talking about the current viewpoints on immigration. You ask in a public opinion poll, for example, you know, who's the first population that comes to mind when you use the word undocumented immigrant, and it's clearly Mexican, right? So I think that's also key here, is that when we're talking about undocumented immigrants, for the most part, the public and inherently, I think, members of Congress are thinking principally about Latino immigrants. So I think those two dynamics are at play. The state of the economy obviously has a huge context in what we're talking about now with immigration policy, as well as the role of race. And I think it's shifted in the context of being focused much more on unauthorized or undocumented immigrants in this particular debate. And this is all within the backdrop of the rising role of the Latino vote, obviously, in recent elections. So I think if you look at the 2012 election, it's no secret to anybody who's probably paying attention to this that Latinos were the big story of the election. Our Latino Decisions data strongly suggests that immigration policy was, for many voters, the key issue on Latino politics side of it, driving how they voted. More recently, we just asked this in a current public opinion poll, Latino Decisions, nearly 60% of Latinos nationwide cite immigration reform as the most important issue to them personally and to Latinos overall. And so I think that's really the backdrop, this evolving role of Latinos in the overall electorate. And clearly, I think the 2012 election was a watershed moment where Latinos not only were arguably very decisive in the election, but they were citing immigration policy and the prospect of comprehensive immigration reform as a driving factor not only in that election, but elections moving forward. So I think that gives you kind of the context of where the politics are, and obviously both parties are trying to capitalize on that. The GOP recognizes that this might be a big opportunity if they get it right to have some major inroads with the Latino vote. The Democratic Party sees this as an opportunity potentially to galvanize the Latino vote for a long period of time. So there's major, major political stakes in how this actually develops. And our data strongly suggests that either party, whether it's the GOP or the Democratic Party, if they really want to make inroads and really solidify the Latino vote with comprehensive immigration reform, the key is it's got to have a pathway to citizenship. Our data has consistently noted this over time. It's not just passing a bill, but that bill has to have that key dynamic for Latinos of a pathway to citizenship. Without that, I don't think you're going to see the big political ramifications that many people are talking about.
You have looked at all of these policies that were enacted on the state levels. A lot of them were punitive, as you called them. How do you see the dynamic between these immigrant policies, voting and mobilization, and new representation?
Well, that's key, too. I'm glad you brought that up, because in the historical narrative, we heard very clearly that this has moved from being primarily the states that took the initiative on immigration policies to the federal government. And now many people are not aware of this. There's record numbers of state bills being proposed and passed across the United States related to immigration policy. Literally for the past several years, it's been a record every year in terms of the action on immigration. There's some variation. There's some what I would refer to as non-punitive laws being passed by states. You see quasi-DREAM Acts, for example, being passed in several states while the federal government was not able to handle that issue earlier. But for the most part, you're seeing a lot of punitive. And obviously, the most salient, the ones that most of the folks listening in will know about, is obviously Arizona and Alabama, that were probably the most publicized, at least in terms of what they were doing in terms of punitive relations to undocumented immigrants in particular. But there's a lot of that happening across the country. And in particular, when you look at Alabama and the southern states, part of that is, although there's relatively small numbers of overall Latinos as well as Latino immigrants in those states, the percentage increase over time, just in 10 years, in some cases over 1,000% increase. So I think you're having places that really didn't have very many Mexican immigrants at all to now having relatively small numbers, but to them it's like overnight huge explosion of that population. And that's having direct implications in terms of state legislatures moving very quickly, passing immigration laws or trying to pass immigration laws, and in some cases being held up in the courts. And I think you're going to see more of that if the federal government doesn't really tackle this issue. And it's going to be uneven like we're seeing now. And in some cases, you're going to see some states moving in a more liberal direction. Unfortunately, for Latinos at least, a lot of these laws are being passed that are much more punitive in nature.
David Reimers, let's bring you back in. When we look at the federal legislation that is being proposed, you talked about the economic forces that were driving immigration policies in the past. When we look at the current legislation, there seems to be two key issues. One is the path to citizenship, but the other has to do with this temporary work visa for so-called unskilled labor. How does this fit?
In World War I, we actually had a law. They suspended the immigration laws to allow about 90,000 Mexicans come in the United States to work temporarily, you know, low-skilled jobs. And then in World War II, the Bracero Agreement came in, which has a bearing on what we're talking about today, because the Bracero Agreement got switched from the Labor Department to the Agriculture Department, which was much more sympathetic to large growers. The workers were supposed to be paid the prevailing wage. Many people believe that was as low as possible. And some of the conditions they lived under were pretty horrendous. On the other hand, they were able to come to the United States and legally find some work for periods of 6 months. And the time that was in effect from 1942 to 1965, about 5 million braceros came to work in the United States, mainly in agriculture and mainly in the West. That wasn't necessarily 5 million different people, but some people signed on again the next year and so forth. 1965, when the end of the Bracero program, mainly liberals and labor unions were pushing to end it because they thought it was exploited labor, which in many ways it was. Then, of course, that was shut off, and then the 65 Act also put a lid on Western Hemispheric immigration, which was aimed at Latin America. Rather clearly, they didn't care about Canada. And the limit was 120,000. Well, people who couldn't come on as a temporary worker then came in into the United States without authorization. And to some extent, that's still hanging around today, the background of all this. We have a lot of temporary worker programs, programs for high-skilled people. We have programs for clergymen. We have programs for people that pick apples. I'm in a place up in Vermont, and every fall you can see the Jamaicans coming up on short-term work contracts.
It seems rather exploitive.
Well, it kind of is, but on the other hand, for some of the workers who their alternative might be to come illegally and get caught and not be able to live out in the open, it might be an improvement. This is the argument. It goes back and forth and back and forth. And from my standpoint, if the workers are guaranteed certain things and it's supervised, and if it doesn't really drive down American wages, you know, it's possible that the temporary workers could be expanded. There's a big controversy over the whole question of low-skill labor coming in the United States and its impact upon American workers who don't have a high school diploma. Summation, there's exhaustive research on this, the summation would be that it probably has a slight effect, but not all that much. Therefore, it becomes somewhat political. You will find groups opposed to increased levels of immigration saying, oh, Bill Gates and company want to bring in cheap Indian computer experts. They want to hire Americans and so forth. My own philosophical viewpoint about this is that we need to do an awful lot with education in this country, and especially education in overcrowded schools. If you grow up in a rich white family in the United States, you can get a very good education going to a private prep school or live in a good suburb. If you're not in that category, the situation must be different. Currently, it's a very conservative mood in this country, and I don't think we're going to do that much. And for the standpoint of Bill Gates or others who have lobbied for some of this, they want to bring in people who they can pay less. I'm rather cynical about that. On the other hand, Australia and Canada both are trying to attract high-skilled laborers as immigrants. That can be argued to be good for your overall economy.
Gabe Sanchez, how do you see this in terms of the current legislation that is being proposed? How will they impact immigration and how will they impact politics?
The current state of this, just looking at where we started in the context of a big comprehensive immigration reform bill, now as we're moving to the amendment stage, right, where you're seeing a lot of amendments being proposed that might take this in a different direction, the easiest example you can use to pull out what I think will happen at the end of the day is to take a look at the process of crafting the Affordable Care Act. Very similar. You started off with a lot of hoopla about a really comprehensive approach to redoing our healthcare system. And at the end of the day, after it moved through the full political process, a lot of folks scratched their head and said, where's the reform in this particular law? And I think we might see something very similar in the context of immigration. When you look at what was been offered at the beginning from this committee, this grade eight, and then you look at what these amendments might look like, you can really start to speculate when it actually starts to move through the process. At the end of the day, we might get a very watered-down version, might be much more focused on border enforcement. And if anything, we might see this law actually not make it all the way through the process. I mean, I think that's very plausible to see it. And that would be frustrating for a lot of folks who perceived out of this particular election cycle, when there was so much enthusiasm around actually being able to tackle this, because the political will on both sides seemed to be promising, largely on the prospect of courting the Latino vote. And I think the politics of it are so interesting, particularly on the Republican side. A lot of folks forget that before 9/11, former President Bush was really going to take a very aggressive approach to comprehensive immigration reform. And I think that really gave you some viewpoint into the Republican Party, that although you see a lot of very conservative elements being very vocal in this particular piece of legislation, behind the scenes there's a lot of Republicans who are proponents of immigration reform, largely because of what we've been talking about, the need for labor, both skilled and unskilled labor. And so I think that gave some optimism that, hey, this might be able to all be ironed out. But right now, it looks, at least in some of these contexts of the amendments being proposed, that it's clear that pathway to citizenship will be the major wedge issue, probably the most complicated aspect of it. Because on some viewpoints, without pathway to citizenship, it's not really reform. At least in the minds of most Latino voters, that's really what they're talking about when they say we want reformed immigration. And on the other end, if we don't have increased border enforcement, we can't get this done. And really the dilemma is which comes first. You're hearing conservatives say if it doesn't happen first in the context of border enforcement, we won't let it happen. And liberals are saying the exact opposite. Let's deal with the pathway to citizenship and the comprehensive immigration across other issues, and then we'll get around to border enforcement. The politics involved are going to make this very tricky and very difficult to pass at the end of the day.
One of the things that I noticed was that labor unions were also coming in to negotiate on this. Where are they in the whole debate?
It's kind of a moving target. I think it depends on what aspect of the bill or the law we're talking about. So it's not one where you can say, well, all labor is on this side or that side of it. I think it's going to wax and wane depending on what elements of the law are emphasized.
In Vermont, the dairy workers cannot get their children to work anymore in the dairy farms. And in Addison County, where we are, there's about 2,500 Mexican workers who do not have papers. And the local sheriffs won't arrest them unless they're really in this serious trouble, because they know that the dairy farms in that county are very, very important for the economy. We had some contact with some of the families, and they've been living there for several years, and they simply have to rely upon these workers. And there are other areas in our economy like that. One more thing about this border enforcement. About 40% of all people without authorization are what we call visa abusers. They come in, they fill out an I-94 card for 3 months or 4 months as visitors, whatever. They come in as students, et cetera. About 40 million people coming into the country from outside, apart from the border. And then they just simply disappear. And the immigration authorities have not been able to track down when they leave. They have not developed over all these years an adequate system to know whether or not they have left. Spending more money on the border is a waste of money. We've reached the law of diminished returns. I think my colleague is absolutely correct. Conservatives will say, we've got to have a secure border. What does that mean? Catching 20,000 persons over a whole year? You'll never get that. That could kill the whole bill.
Let me just ask you, David Reimers, as a historian, if you were going to use the past to predict the future, and I know historians don't like to do predictions, but could you say where you see this going with all the history that you've got up until this point? How does this resolve?
First of all, these laws tend to be a series of compromises, giving and taking, whatever, and so forth. Second of all, there are a lot of unintended consequences of immigration. Third, the legislatures don't always see what they're doing. I've got an article sitting on my desk I'm going to send off. It's about the ceiling of 120,000 for the Western Hemisphere. It didn't work. It was almost dead when it was passed, because Johnson, the same day he signs the bill, says we'll admit all the Cubans who want to come. And after a few years, they decided they come outside the ceiling. And in the same law, there's a provision for immediate family members to come over the quota. Who are immediate family members? They are spouses, minor children, and parents of adult U.S. citizens. Immediate family members now are running about 450,000 a year. They thought it was going to be about one-tenth of that number. Whatever Congress does, I'm very cynical. I think they often don't know what they're doing, and they put in things of that sort, and then they won't fund it or what have you. I just don't see it coming out in any coherent kind of way, and Congress is trying to do an awful lot with that bill. They're trying to knock out the lottery, which is probably not a good way to admit immigrants. They're trying to knock out to the brothers and sisters category, and that's going to hit a lot of ethnic groups. There'll be a big fight over that. And how do we have a provision in our law to let in 65,000 siblings of U.S. citizens every year? Well, that was because you go back to 1965, and they're trying to reform the law. They discovered the biggest backlog of people waiting were brothers and sisters of U.S. citizens, primarily from Italy. So they put that in as the major category. the law is sometimes called the brothers and sisters law. So they put things in for one reason, and another thing happened. The lottery got in there because the Irish managed to lobby Congress and some support from European groups, too, to get the Irish in because they couldn't satisfy the new law. So you did it by lottery. And the Irish won the first couple lotteries very big, so they were guaranteed this. But they stopped coming after a while. And the lottery now is of great benefit to Africa and certain places in Asia like Bangladesh and Pakistan. I mean, you put a law in for one group, which is not a good idea in some ways, and it turns out 8 years down the road something else happens. It's very hard to predict all these things. You just don't know where it comes out. I mean, Obama is supposed to be a liberal president, but he's deporting 400,000 people a year under their administration. Most of those people are not hardened criminals.
Gabriel Sanchez, let's get the political science perspective on this also. How do you see the future shaping up?
I think in the context of this particular bill, the clear debate that's in play, law enforcement, border enforcement versus pathway to citizenship, one side's going to have to cave on that. I think it's clear to me that in order for Democrats to get the pieces of this that they want, they're going to have to allow border enforcement to increase, whatever that means. That's a difficult thing to define. What does that mean? More boots on the ground, so to speak, more technology employed. But whatever that shakes out, I think in order for this bill to pass, you're going to have to see some elements of border enforcement.
And then how do you see also the next wave of politics shaping as a result? As we see, there's this kind of dynamic between policy and politics. How do you see the next wave of politics?
The key thing to understand is that Latino voters are incredibly savvy on immigration policy, much more than I think they're given credit for. So a couple quick data points to throw at you. You know, my colleague brought up the notion of deportation. Latinos are very closely connected to that in the context of even among Latino voters, so all U.S. citizens. About a quarter of the U.S. Latino population of their electorate know somebody personally who's been deported. So and those folks, their attitudes about the president, because they're acutely aware that was on his watch, are not that positive. So I think the politics of this are going to be, if neither party is really able to get this done, Latino voters are going to hold both parties accountable for that. And I think this notion that, look, electoral politics is being swung permanently because Latino voters are unhappy with the Republican Party long term, I think the key there is that's a pretty soft stance for Latino voters in terms of their connection to the Democratic Party. They were kind of in a tough spot in this particular election. They realized that the deportation numbers under Obama were very unpositive from their mindset, but they also realized at least the candidates on the Republican side with self-deportation were worse on immigration. So I think the politics of this are really going to depend on how this debate actually ensues. Whether a bill is passed or not, whichever party is perceived to be the most demonizing towards immigrants, I think Latino voters are going to remember that. And given the demography that we're looking at in the U.S., with Latino voters playing a more and more critical role in elections moving forward, that's going to be the key dynamic, is which party can emerge from this perceived to be more in line with Latinos' interests, even if a bill is not passed.
Gabriel Sanchez and David Reimers, thank you very much.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun.
Gabriel Sanchez is professor of political science at the University of New Mexico and the author of numerous publications, including the book Hispanics and the U.S. Political System, Moving into the Mainstream. David Reimers is a professor emeritus of history at the University of Wisconsin. His books include Unwelcome Strangers, American Identity and the Turn Against Immigration. He's also co-author of Natives and Strangers, A Multicultural History of Americans. That's it for today's Scholar Circle. Thank you to our guests and to our producers, Melissa Chipranankine Agassian and Leonardo Alana, for making this show possible. Also to Sud Dongre, our webmaster, and most of all to you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can go back to kpfk.org and click on the archives, or to our own archives at armudian.com and scholarcircle.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher or iTunes, and follow us on Twitter at armudian.